Today's session is the heart of healthcare, and I'm Don Russo. This is a series about healthcare through this week that has looked at the factors that drive American healthcare and has asked the question, does fear, power, and money drive American healthcare? And we've looked at values in healthcare and the history of healthcare, the changes in America's healthcare system, and some of the factors that have prompted those changes. And there has been some criticism and of American healthcare here that represents maybe a general attitude across America. There's a lot of criticism in America today about healthcare, and yet there's a huge amount of resources devoted to healthcare. And when someone becomes ill, there's great means to help heal. But there are some inconsistencies and some things that people aren't happy about. And so this question, do fear, power, and money drive healthcare, has been a rhetorical one. And I'd suggest today the heart of healthcare is not fear, power, and money, as we oftentimes think of those terms in negative ways. But there is a very positive side of healthcare, a heart of healthcare that is very Christian. Then these factors battle each other daily, and the definition that we started with at the beginning of the week, I think, would still be worth looking at today. I suggested that we define healthcare as the struggle to do good against the inherent imperfections of humanity. And that good versus bad battle that goes on in life is intensified oftentimes in healthcare when a serious illness or injury threatens one's life. And it raises these questions about the meaning of life and death, and why we're here, and where we're going, and who we are. And so it's those essential questions that I think are at the heart of healthcare. And I'd like to today look at three pieces of literature, two poems and one piece of scripture, to explore a little bit more about this question of where is the heart of healthcare. So with a couple of you, my name is Don Russo. I work at a hospital in Klamath Falls, Oregon, called Murrow West Medical Center. And I work in administration. I'm not a clinical person. And I teach at a college next door that trains people, Oregon Institute of Technology, that trains people to enter the healthcare professions in nursing and diagnostic imaging and a couple of other technologies. And so that's where I'm coming from, is a small town in rural America. And I think many of these things hold true wherever we might live and work. We have some people here who work. I know Paul has been with us here. Paul is in the insurance, has been in the insurance side of things, understands that financial perspective, has been contributing his experience and perspective in a good way. And I'm sorry,
Linda.
Mm-hmm. Linda. Linda's a nurse entering a graduate program in community health.
And have been working in community development.
Community development. Do you work in healthcare, or just have the patient perspective to add?
I'm not working in healthcare or involved with it in any way right now, but for a number of years of my life, I was involved with the College of Human Medicine at Michigan State University, which was the time of a brand new medical college in the 1960s, and I was in charge of the public relations effort to get the college accepted in the state.
Oh.
But and so I became very close to a number of people in healthcare and the teaching of medical doctors and so on. So I have always been very much interested in it from that point.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm.
Back in the days when they were first starting to talk about HMOs and things like this, Kaiser Permanente was the only one around. And, although I haven't been involved with that for a number of years, it's been interesting to watch it grow.
Yeah, good. And you, sir?
I'm Tom, and I'm a nurse.
You're a nurse.
I'm a nurse practitioner, family nurse practitioner with the University of Washington in the Seattle area. So I a part-time lecturer in the nursing programs and do clinical precepting. And primarily, though, I earn money for the University of Washington by running a clinic in a juvenile detention. So I provide health care to the detained youth of King County.
You and Linda may come into contact over the next few years.
You're just there to earn money for the University of Washington.
Well, every university has to have some way to pay the bills.
I know. But I'm hoping you're doing some good for the youth.
Oh, yeah, but, well, I mean, the idea is they subcontract my services. So they like every professor there, or in my case, lecturer, does work as his teacher, but also has to do clinical skills. And so my clinical skills are utilized.
I understood what you were saying. I just had to call you.
Okay.
Well, we've looked at these concepts of fear, power, and money in a negative and positive way. Just to review a little bit, you say fear in a negative way. Illness, injury is a threat. We feel at times that we hang by a thread and that the end is near sometimes when something severe happens, an illness or an injury. And responding out of fear to something makes us weak in a sense and drives need. We need something beyond our own means to heal, to get better. So we turn to the medical profession, not often voluntarily, but we need out of need. And so that gives rise to power, that those in clinical positions, in healthcare, financial positions, and in other ways have certain power because somebody needs something from someone. When you have something someone needs, you have more power. And we just complicate it a little further by saying we live in a capitalistic society, and our healthcare system is driven by capitalistic forces. And money is a way we exchange value. It's a symbol of worth, and we exchange quid pro quo. I'll do this for you, you do that for me. I provide a service, you pay me. It's a healthcare business relationship. And it's the negative, the love of money, that gets us into trouble sometimes when people take advantage and abuse their power and play on people's fears. So we kind of set the stage. You know, there's something on the negative side that happens in America, but that's not the only way to look at it. And we want to try and examine how are these factors working in a positive way too in American healthcare. And I suggest that fear, if we look in Proverbs, just in the first couple of verses there, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so if we say, you know, fear of the Lord in a respectful, awesome way, gives us life, gives us intelligence and the means to use our resources to help others, it really has a foundation in our spirituality. Power, the power of the Lord. Well, where's the origin of power? if you say the origin of power is in God, we are his instruments to carry that forward. And money is a symbol of worth. It's only the love of money that is criticized in the Bible, not money itself. And so in a capitalistic society, money can be a very positive thing to help make things happen, and we certainly have a standard of living that testifies to what money can do. So that's kind of what we've gone through here this week. But if we look at the church as the body of Christ, and let's look at healthcare as a body, we'd say, you know, where are the hands? You know, you two have, you know, your hands. You're in the hands. Your work. The mind, you know, the head, the mind of this body is the reasoning that goes into science. It goes into medicine. And medicine is a science driven by reason. But where is the heart? What is in the heart of healthcare? And that's the question for today. And I'm going to start with a poem that comes out of this book, Medicine and Western Civilization. Some historians, medical history, is their interest, have looked at through time things that express our values of Western civilization that are in medicine and these forces that have battled through time. And the very last passage here in this book, which is generally a very positive book, is a poem by an Englishman who died in 1985. And I'd like to read this. This is a view of life or death that sometimes some people hold. And it's a negative view. This is a poet who's a bright guy, Oxford scholar. Philip Larkin is the name. I don't know if you've heard this name. But I want to look at this poem as and contrast it with another poem by William Blake, who lived far earlier. But here's a modern poem, a modern poet looking at the death, and this guy isn't too happy. But this is a force that's out there in healthcare and in life. And see what you think of this. I didn't want to trouble Holden to make copies of this for everybody. It's a bit long. I do have copies of the next one. So let me read this and see what you think. But this is a guy who's not too happy. It says, I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there. Unresting death, a whole day nearer now, making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation, yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify fear. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never, but at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid, no trick dispels. Religion used to try that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, and specious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel, not seeing that this is what we fear, no sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with, the anesthetic from which none come round. And so it stays just on the edge of vision, a small unfocused blur, a standing chill that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen. This one will. And realization of it rages out in furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different whined at than withstood. Slowly light strengthens and the room takes shape. It stands plain as a wardrobe, what we know, have always known. Know that we can't escape, yet can't accept. One side will have to go. Meanwhile, telephones crouch, getting ready to ring in locked up offices, and all the uncaring, intricate, rented world begins to rouse. The sky is white as clay with no sun. Work has to be done. Postmen, like doctors, go from house to house. Have you seen that view of death? Have you felt anything like that? Have you seen that?
Why was that place there?
To rouse us, I believe.
Gloomy.
He's an unhappy person.
No wonder he drank.
Yeah.
Probably not too happy to lies either.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm.
No.
Our extremes of emotion bring out, they're often represented in poetry.
as those type of people who experience extremes in emotion seem to be able to put it on paper and do a good job. This is one extreme of fear, fear of death.
Yeah.
And there is another extreme. It's just not at this point.
No, it's not here.
It's not balanced.
It's not here. So we know another point. We'll look at it. But here's what we're, you know, here's the struggle to do good against the inherent imperfections of humanity.
I think she was right. That in that poem, there's a fear of death, but there's a fear of life also.
Oh,
he talks about the rented world.
Rented space.
Yeah, because I don't belong.
Waiting for morning.
Waiting for morning,
Waiting for what? It's empty.
Mm-hmm. One more day closer.
One more day closer to death. Yeah. Have you seen patients with that view? Have you seen family with that view? Have you had anything like that yourself? Not quite, huh?
I think it's a view that you can have moments of, almost anything, you can have moments of feeling like, what's it all worth? There's been so much history behind us, and so much history will be coming. What are we? Mm-hmm. But, hopefully that's not your whole entire thoughts for the whole day.
Yeah.
It's not your total view.
Yeah.
Well, I would think it's very common when people sit in front of a TV set. Isn't that what they're doing? You know, just taking up space?
Rented space.
Well,
not necessarily, I don't think.
The writer, if I were to personify him, it'd be a widowed man who thinks he hadn't done much right in the world except possibly with his marriage or something, and he lost that too.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Pass that around if you want to look at those lines. Yeah, that fits kind of the little description they give.
At the time this was written, in 1895, was it?
No, he died in 1985. Yeah, this is a modern poet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that, for the last century, it would be more understandable because at 1895, at least, it was a toss-up as to whether doctors did more harm than good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you probably...
I think it's still a toss-up.
Well, this is the modern world. This is a voice in the modern world.
An interesting thing I read yesterday, I finally found a paper, and I was reading an article about suicide, and suicide in the West and in Washington, and Washington State is one of the leading states in the country for suicide, with a rate of 12 per 100,000 in a five-year period of time. A lot of people that are killing themselves, taking their own lives.
Yeah.
That could be, it has something to do with the climate and the weather. Especially
sad,
in the winter.
Seattle affective disorder.
You mean last week at
Holden? Actually, it's seasonal affective disorder, but here in Seattle, we change it to read Seattle affective disorder.
But you know, the one of the things about this is that if doctors, in particular, I think probably everybody, perhaps everybody in the health profession, but death is the enemy, you know, and sometimes it shouldn't be, but they make death the enemy even when it shouldn't be, so apparently. The goal was to prolong life when life didn't be prolonged, or might not. There's still concern for the quality of life, you know.
Yeah. I had a chat with a man right before I came up here, and he had contracted colon cancer 5 years ago, and he has been fighting it ever since. It's spread, and each time he turns around, they're cutting something away, and he continues getting chemotherapy and radiation. And I went out to his home, and he said, "Well, I've quit." I'd rather have whatever time I have left feeling good. I kind of welcome what's going to come, because the last 5 years haven't been very pleasant. And he says, you know, I know that it could be prolonged, but why? Why prolong it when it's inevitable? And why prolong it when to do so creates something he didn't want? Mm-hmm. Pain and suffering and being sick all the time. And he was out working in his vegetable garden and tinkering with his Model A and looking at his boat that he's making a wooden boat, and he said, well, I won't have time to finish that, so I'm giving that to my son. My son can finish that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know that it's an unwelcome thing. Yeah. And in his point, in his view, I don't know that I would look at it differently.
Yeah. Well, I only bring this poem because it's striking in its expression of one extreme, and that's a real extreme, but there's a lot of negatives that exist in people and that are brought to healthcare. And so it tests patients and providers and payors, you know, everybody, as to what are their values, what's important here, why am I pursuing this? So to go from that to something else, let's take a look at the second reading and a piece of scripture that is probably familiar to all of you.
I wonder if he thought it was a coincidence that he died of throat cancer when he was someone who stuttered as a child.
Oh, you picked that up.
Yeah. It seems like a little too much of everything or something. Yeah. I'm sure he felt that way.
He had no faith.
No.
No hope.
No, he had no faith. No.
Little love.
At the time of the pinning of that poem.
I look at his...
There could have just been 1 week in his life.
You know, it's funny, too, that at his age, he was born in 22, I think, 1922, which means he survived the Depression, but also, you know, the Great Expansion after the war, when people's standard of living expanded so quickly and so mm-hmm. So much.
Yeah. Well, rather than go with that extreme, many in healthcare go with a more positive, you know, the struggle to do good. And man, many take their direction, their teaching from Scripture, from the life of Jesus. And if we look at Jesus as a healer, and healing the sick, and even overcoming death, you know, then there are ways, teachings there that can help in how we view healthcare. And that's what I suggest is really at the heart of healthcare. And Linda's session yesterday explored this with the concept of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit, the Creator, Healer, and community. Today I'd like to to look at a passage in Luke known as the Walk to Emmaus, the Journey to Emmaus, if you're familiar with that. And it's here. Would someone else like to read? Who's a good reader? Want to read it before?
I'll read it.
It starts right there, 13, mm-hmm. goes till 36.
Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other as you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. Where do I stop? There.
Go to the end of 35.
The end of 35. I thought it was a good stop sign. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" The same hour he got up and returned to Jerusalem, they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
A familiar story to you, I'm sure, and it has its own meaning, you know, clear meaning. I just bring it here today as a way to consider maybe in an allegorical in a metaphor sense about healthcare. I'm not trying to say this is about healthcare, but to me it just made me think about healthcare. And there are some passages that let's go back over here and explain what I'm getting out of this. As they walked along, these guys walked along with Jesus. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So if the walk is our life's walk, and here he is with us and we don't recognize him, that surely happens. It's happened in my life in a period of years at times, but I think it happens in healthcare. And the walk, you know, the work of healthcare is intense and important, and it's going somewhere. And a lot of times people who are there don't recognize its importance. It's easy to go to see other things. Fear, power, and money are seen oftentimes instead of, you know, him, the healer. And then when he did tell them who he is, he says, "Oh, how foolish you are, how slow of heart to believe all that the prophecies have declared." Slow of heart. And if we say, what is the heart of healthcare? Sometimes the heart of healthcare is slow to feel its real heart. And some things are in the way. And yet, when they did recognize him, you know, and afterwards he left them, and they said, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road?" And so this is, you know, our hearts were burning. Were not our hearts burning within us? You know, to me, there is the heart of healthcare in this passage. This is kind of what I bring out of it in relation to this whole huge world of endeavor of healthcare. And I'd suggest that when our hearts burn, it is that
our human form divine is burning. And to make sure that we keep it burning is our challenge, you know, our task is to recognize him and feel burning in our heart. And when that happens, America's healthcare goes forward in a very positive ways on an individual level, person by person, day by day. And it's not that other kind of hopelessness. Now, is that, am I heretical here? Am I just stretching things beyond?
But are you talking about things like burnout, for instance, in the
medical
profession?
Yeah.
Because, it's a wonder to me who, and I'm not in the health care profession, that they, especially an oncologist or someone like that, who can withstand the rigors of every day.
Yeah.
The things that they have to go through. And still, many times, the patient feels the doctor is, uncaring.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Burnout.
Well, I was thinking, my husband died a couple of years ago of bone cancer. And I was extremely unhappy with his position because he died, of course. he didn't tell me. But I mentioned to a neighbor of mine who happened to be the wife of a physician, I said, I've heard nothing from the doctor at all since it died. Not one word of sorry or wish we could have helped him or something. And I said, and when the veterinarian put my cat to sleep, I got a sympathy card from everyone at the pet hospital. I said, it just seemed incredible. Well, she went and mentioned it to her husband. So he came and he said, I'd like to talk to you about that. He said, I feel badly about it when patients die. He said, but it never occurred to me, he said, a sympathy card. I said, well, you should. I'm sure that this doctor had experienced death so many times, but it was my first experience with such a personal death. And, it was over for him. At least that's the way I felt about it. Mm-hmm. I felt that he was too professional. Mm-hmm. And later I began to think, he's seen it so much. Mm-hmm. And especially in this case where it's a cancer that really has no outcome other than death.
And sometimes they have to self-preserve
their own
self. Compartmentalize their life, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think when my husband's father died, we got a note from
the
doctor's office, and that was very nice. Mm-hmm. But we also sent them a note and said, thank you for all your caring and your help. Because it's not their fault he died.
Oh, no. No, I didn't. I'm not blaming, but I mean, I just... The interstitial was saying that, I guess. But there were a lot of circumstances in the way that he died. And, he was at home, and there were a lot of things that I hadn't even seen the doctor really for about a month because he wasn't at home. And of course, they don't make house calls or anything like that, so it was all.
It made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there can be confusion about that. What's the difference between being professional and being cold? And what's the difference between caring and becoming too much involved?
You burst.
Mm-hmm. It's not, sometimes we make some rather silly distinctions.
And some silly expectations too, I think, because I was a teacher for 28 years, and we were constantly hearing, "Don't get involved in a child's life." Well, if you're not involved in the child's life, how can you teach him? Yeah. You have to know the child, and I would think a physician would be. A physician has a much more dangerous acute caring at that time than certainly than a teacher does. But I never bought the story on not becoming involved. If a child's having problems at home, for instance, and there's something you can do to help, and you don't do it because you don't want to become involved, you're not doing very much for the child, I don't think.
Maybe you need to look at the level of education. If you are dealing in an elementary classroom where you have 26 children, it's very easy to get to know them and become involved with them. If you're dealing in a high school with six periods of 35 for a quarter, and then boom, a whole new group coming in, six periods of 35, and then by the end of the year, another group of six periods of 35. Mm-hmm. You are fortunate in that circumstance to get to know their names.
Well, that's certainly true. I think that's a great drawback.
A doctor dealing with a patient load of 400 people, 500 people, 600 people, could be awfully hard. We all know him. We expect him to know us. We know about him. We expect him to know about us.
I had a doctor lose my records one time. That was funny. Because I thought he was going to be about 5 years, but he didn't know who I was without my records. Oh, it was really off the wall. He would ask me, who did this surgery? You did.
Well, the record's outside in the hall, not in there with you. Gives him a minute to talk, who is this person? It would be really helpful if we could take a picture of them. We could put that on the record, too.
Yeah, what do we want
to do? Some people do.
Take a picture of the patient. I was in the hospital for 10 days, and a good friend of mine is an obstetrician, gynecologist. And every morning when he was making rounds, and including the mornings that he wasn't making rounds, he came in and picked up my chart to see how I was doing. And about the third day, the head nurse of the ward came in to say, why is a gynecologist coming to see the ward? I had to explain to her.
Why was it good?
Well, let's take a look at one more poem. It's the very first piece that's in this book. William Blake. Let me just take one of those. Pass the room. So this is a fairly short poem in simple language. But it may serve as a guide for a question about the heart of healthcare. That's why I bring it to your attention here. William Blake was an Englishman. I think lived in the 1600s, before the modern age, certainly. Who would like to try this one? Do you want to read this one?
To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child, and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too.
That's a wonderful poem.
Not bad.
expression of mm-hmm.
Pretty thought-provoking. I like the way the third stanza, third verse there, and it breaks out the mercy, peace, pity, love, and peace. My thoughts were that the first three are definitely human characteristics, but peace, I sometimes wonder, is it really a human characteristic or just a goal? Just a goal. Is it the human dress or is it the divine dress?
It is where healthcare is. Healthcare is provided because of mercy.
He said peace though.
Healthcare is provided because of pity. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is provided because of love. And
hopefully the object of it is peace.
Peace.
Yeah.
Well, and healthcare is provided because God is dwelling in man.
Yeah.
Because there's something divine, something worth saving mm-hmm. about even these strangers that you don't know.
Right.
Which is very interesting. I recently read a book, a novel about the Aztec civilization, and it seemed, you know, be completely devoid of this concept, you know, of individuals themselves being worth saving, you know, because human sacrifice was normal at the time. And people felt, you know, that this book is true reflection of what happened in those days. You know, people didn't feel this really as we do. They came out of an entirely different way of looking at life.
So if an illness or an injury would strike someone, it was more of an acceptance of, oh well.
The central character of the book, life to him was not important except when it was somebody very close to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He must
have watched
television.
Mm-hmm. could be. But I mean, you know, watching somebody, it's a very good analogy because watching somebody having his heart literally ripped out
mm-hmm.
was no more traumatic than watching somebody die on TV. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With no consequences whatsoever.
No, right.
Well, this is what makes our healthcare of high importance and high value. Mm-hmm. And I suggest this is the heart of healthcare. This is, you know, the driving value in a world that's difficult. There are pressures and forces trying to rob us of this. And yet our rewards and our satisfaction come more from this than the other.
I think Tom, mm-hmm. I think he really had a good point in saying that peace is more a goal. And I noticed from the bottom of the last stanza, he says, mercy, love, and pity dwell there. God is dwelling too. He just mentioned peace. Certainly God is dwelling in peace. But it's certainly, it seems like a goal that's unattainable by one. You know, it seems like it's something that has to be a community type thing.
Linda.
I'm thinking it has to be both, actually. That in recognizing who we are and the value that we contain, peace, and within the community, we need to bring that personal sense of peace in our relationship with the community. And then we need to be working for the peace of the community.
I'm sure that in Linda's class she talked about, so often people in our society, our culture, fall into a framework of thinking of doctors as healthcare. And doctors are just one instrument of healthcare. The community is the provides the whole panoply or the whole arena of healthcare. The village plumber who spoke this morning is part of the healthcare system of this village.
Right.
And everyone is a part of the healthcare system. Doctors are taught to recognize something from one perspective. That's why there's Western medicine and there's Eastern medicine and there's other types of medicine. They have different perspectives of looking at the same symptom set or the same set of circumstances. And they're taught to do specific things for that. And plumbers are taught the same way, but they also have learned that things in plumbing, or things in carpentry, or things in auto mechanics, or things in teaching can be crossed over. And they can provide insight to someone who is having fear about their health that can help them allay that fear to some extent, to cope with that and to make the proper decisions and have the right aspect. I'm very biased, and I think that nursing is probably the only U.S. medicine or healthcare type profession that tries to not look at healing the person through things or through surgery or through medicine, but healing the person through education, through knowledge, and helping them cope with the situation they're in. You know, sometimes you can't change your situation. Sometimes you just have to learn how to make the best out of the situation, and that's a focus of nursing. We also support at the same time helping people learn how to change their situation.
Mm. Awesome.
And research.
Research is important.
A person who is doing research and never leaves the lab, but still makes giant contributions to healthcare.
Now that's, of course, research is one of the differences in research and education and so on. One of the differences between Western medicine and other geographical areas of medicine, and what I've been wondering about is what has been the contribution of Christianity to Western medicine? Because the people that have developed their system of medicine have been nominally at least Christians. And some of them very good Christians, obviously. But you know, what way has that made our Western medicine different? What is the link there?
Especially if you look at Asian medicine. Hmm? Especially if you look at Asian medicine, which is not based on Christianity.
Yeah.
What? My perspective is that the Christianity's allopathy is the correct term for Western medicine.
Okay.
And the influence of Christianity on allopathy has been to make death the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are raised, and I was raised in a Baptist church, and I was raised to have fear for some things, to respect the power of things, and I think that kind of comes into allopathy, into Western medicine. There are fearful things, and we need to develop ways to combat these fearful things.
Mm-hmm.
Death is a fearful thing. Life without a limb is a fearful thing. Life without vision is fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has driven, I think, some Christian values that we want to maintain ourselves as whole as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of drives us to go that way. I don't know. I don't think that I'm saying this the way I really mean it, though. I'm stumbling here.
All of us are, I think.
It's...
I think that we have a problem in that within our Christian and our Western history, there's the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And what do they call that? Cartesian thinking, where you have to be able to say, I can see that this causes this. And it's a kind of a narrowing of our focus of vision. And that's become part of our heritage, which is both helpful but also hurtful. Mm-hmm. It has helped us to learn how to do surgery and how to develop medicines of some kinds. But it has neglected the wider scope of things that you can't measure, you know. Mm-hmm. When I think of Chinese medicine, it's set within a context of the whole universal thinking of how the universe works. Mm-hmm. And then your provision of acupuncture, acupressure, for instance, fits into that whole idea of this is the way the universe is put together. And when I'm trying to pursue what I'm after, it's partly out of a feeling that Christianity surely must have a similar view of the universe into which we can set all of our thinking about health.
Part of it may be the way that we view each other and the way that we view society and the history of our Christianity. It has been the learned people that have kept Christianity going and broadened Christianity. It is a caring of other people and a caring of society and a set of values that sometimes are not found. Even you mentioned China. Human life in China is not on the same plane as human life in America. We view life differently than there. If a child is burned in China, it's only a child. If a child is born crippled, well, we'll have others.
I don't think that's true at all.
I just came back from China.
Oh, did you?
And I was working there with hospitals dealing with crippled children and with burns. In Hong Kong, the only people that care about burned children, of course, are the immediate parents, because they have, but the government, well, oh, it's a child, you know, if it's burned badly, well, there are other children.
But the philosophy of Asian medicine is certainly not a non-caring one.
No, but it's not a progressing one. It's not finding out if there is something better around the corner that we don't know about yet. And how do we get around the corner and get there? Oh, acupuncture is wonderful, but it has been the same as it's been for how many generations? Mm-hmm. Yesterday's newspaper from Seattle has a picture of Harborview Hospital and a person working at Harborview, the trauma center for the whole area. And they have a new miracle drug that, if given within the first four hours of a tragic body shaking injury, this drug does something to the white blood cells and keeps them from running amok, and the chances of saving people with this new experimental drug that they're using there compounds the success rate greatly. In the Eastern culture, I don't think you would find that kind of a development. And if they did find it, it wouldn't be on the front page of their paper. For us, it's important. our healthcare is important. Our relationship with each other is important. I'm certain we all know the history, again in the Eastern civilization, of the male child and the female child. What value does a girl baby have compared to a boy baby?
Well, we still struggle with that here, too.
We have a different value, huh? My daughter is just as important to me as my son.
I think you've got a lot of merit in what you're saying. Because it seems to me that if our civilization would have progressed in the terms of healthcare, much like the Eastern would have if it hadn't been for the Renaissance and the things that went with that, because in the church of the Middle Ages, everything was medicine, I'm sure, being one of the things, was forced into the confines of Christianity as it was understood then, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, people went by what they believed, you know. The only authority was the church. The only authority, not the scriptures really, but the church. And everything, you know, Copernicus, for example, you know, he couldn't be believed, you know, the earth wasn't, when he said the earth wasn't the center of the universe, people didn't believe that because, you know, the church at the time had a different view of the universe than what was observable. And medicine, in the same way, you know, is the scientific method is the thing that distinguishes our medicine from the Eastern kind of medicine. And I think maybe Eastern medicine in its own ways, is just as caring as ours. It's, you know, because I think the reason why our Eastern medicine has become popular today or people are interested in it because it represents a more holistic type of medicine than ours has been traditionally over in this century at least, you know, where we cared, medicine became so compartmentalized, you know, you look at this part of this organ and that organ and so on, and we forgot the holistic part, which was still being retained in Eastern medicine, and that's what is very nice about that. But if it hadn't been for the people like Martin Luther and so on, who believed in the value of education, so that everybody, you know, was entitled to an education or could live up to his potential of learning, that made it possible to have the scientific method, that made it possible to have mass education and all the other things that have made our medicine different from medicine in other parts of the world.
But somehow I have a feeling that...
I'm stumbling over this. I hope you're getting the general drift.
We both were.
I think that the sort of what you're talking about is the technology of medicine, which to me is the least human part of it. But I mean,
that's true. But it's also one of the things that makes it successful.
Well, yes. But I mean, it's sort of like saying we have the most wonderful health care in the world, without ever looking at what the rest of the world has.
Well, in America, we have the most wonderful health care in the world for people that can afford it.
Yeah.
You know, but if you look at child mortality rates, you know, we're abysmal compared to a lot of the other Western countries.
Well, we just had a doctor in Peru, for instance, who operates on hearts that are enlarged and makes them smaller. And you know, so there are developments in other parts of the country that are not technologically as advanced as we are. And I certainly applaud that of technology, certainly. I mean, I wouldn't want to do without it. But I think there's a human thing, too, that is not applauded as much in Western medicine, as it might be.
Well, it depends, you know. When I speak of technology, I'm thinking of things as basic as germ theory, you know. and that's part of it. I mean, Pasteur was revolutionary, you know. It really was. Mm-hmm. And that's technology in a way, because it's scientific method that when it was going for Pasteur that just, you know, in itself revolutionized Western medicine. because until then we had no idea what caused most illness.
We still don't know.
Yeah.
Well, we use the theory. We don't know.
Yeah.
The germs are they may just be a vehicle along the way, not the root of the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. But interesting. But if the goal is to save lives, to help relieve misery and so on, you know, nothing has been more important to medicine than the antibiotics, and antibiotics wouldn't be possible without a knowledge, understanding of microbiology.
Yeah. Pasteur was amazing, refocusing.
But he was doing it to save the wine industry, you know, more than the prolonging human life.
So, you had something to say.
Oh, I was just saying, my understanding of that whole conversation was, without the heart, without the concern, we may not have gotten the technology. So technology in itself isn't the bad guy. If we look at, try to use the technology without the heart, then that's bad. But I think in our society, it started out with the wanting to make things better for people.
I guess what I'm thinking is that Christianity is important because one of the things that it does, or one of the things that it's done under the guidance of Martin Luther, is to let the human being live up to his full potential. And that has been the thing that has made the difference in science. So in this way, this is another way of looking at Christianity, mm-hmm. and looking at, you know, I think God wants us all to use the gifts that He gave us, and one of the gifts that He gave us is our intellect. And if we don't use them to the maximum potential, we're not being good servants.
I just want to throw something in. Working at a major medical school, the face of medicine is changing. We've seen it been changing for the last 2 to 3 years radically. 10 years ago, some people with foresight might have seen it changing. Today, let's take for the class of this 97 class of 2000. Coming out of University of Washington School of Medicine, is going to have it's going to be 65% to 70% female.
Really?
Doctors. The class that just applied for medical school, entry into medical school, was 60% of the applicants were female, but like I said, some stories between 65% and 70% of them, those accepted were female. Because they're better prepared for the rigors of medical school than the male applicants that are applying now. It's gonna change the outlook to some extent, because I think there's gonna be more caring back into medicine. Medicine has been a school of medicine that does nothing to prepare a doctor for dealing with death or birth. Or they teach them skills and technologies, and they don't teach them how to deal with the relationships that are involved when you utilize these skills. And I think that's a characteristic that's found in everyone, and in our culture today, we find it more readily in the women of our culture. And I think it's going to bring more of it back into the doctor-patient relationship in the future. I also think that, kind of give you a little history lesson. 50 years ago, the most common practitioner of medicine in the United States was a homeopathic physician. How many of you know what a homeopathic physician is? All right. They're not around. I mean, there's like one in Edmonds, and there might be one in Bothell, and there's maybe 100 in a state in the United States now that practice homeopathy. In 1950,
the fastest growing medical schools in the nation were osteopathy. Mm-hmm. ODs, not MDs.
DOs.
DOs, right. Not ODs. OD is doctor of ophthalmology, right?
Right.
Right.
But not an ophthalmologist.
But not an ophthalmologist.
An optometrist.
Doctor of optometry, yeah.
Yeah, optometry. Right. And so so we've had some changes historically, fairly recently, where we've gone from homeopathy to allopathy, and I think we're going to have more of a blend coming out. As much, we've had some discussion about acupuncture, acupressure. I think things are going to change. I think people are going to realize that relationships are as much a part of healing and surviving as technology, although I don't think